Ma, the spicy huajiao, is the sixth flavor unique to Sichuan, though la, hot peppers, is also typical of the area. Tian, meaning sweet, suan, meaning sour, xian, meaning salty, and ku, meaning bitter, are universal. Each dish will have a flavor, or ideally a combination of flavors, ma la being the most famous Sichuan combination. Xian, salty, is the most used flavor, a central motif. It is considered a balance to all the others. Salt is believed to bring out sweetness and moderate sourness. In ancient times, tea was prepared in Sichuan with salt and ginger added. Salty and spicy, Xian La, is such a popular Sichuan combination that it has been bottled in the form of soy sauce and hot peppers. Xian La is also a recurrent theme in other warm climates from Cajun Louisiana to Vietnam, where ground hot pepper and salt are served on limes, grapefruit, or pineapple to moderate the acid taste. In China, meals are put together by counterbalancing these combinations. Balance, making a complete flavor by blending opposites, like combining an acid and a base in chemistry, is an ancient concept in cooking. The 4th century BC Chinese belief that the world is made up of two opposing forces, yin and yang, has long been applied to cooking. The Chinese classify foods into warm and cold according to their attributes, not their temperature, similar to the way Europeans classified and balanced foods in the Middle Ages. All cooks do not agree on which foods are hot and which cold. But fat meat, hot spices, and alcohol are usually thought to be hot, while bland vegetables and fruit are usually considered cold. In the West, such ideas trace back at least to Hippocrates in 5th century BC Greece. Some scholars believe the idea originated in Greece and spread to Asia through India. Others argue that different cultures thought of it independently. Some scholars believe that indigenous North Americans held these beliefs before the arrival of Europeans. Such ideas were the basis of the church's lean and fat day interdictions. But in time, they degenerated in Europe to such frivolousness as Grimaud de la Reynière's distinction between blonde and brunette food. As with women, he preferred his food blonde. Ancient concepts, such as hot and cold foods, are still seriously discussed in China. Dishes that are ma la, or dishes that are very salty, are contrasted with bland dishes. But also tian, sweet, is considered a good counterbalance to ma la. Tian Shao Bai, which literally means sweet white stew, consists of thick bacon strips stuffed with sweet bean paste on a bed of sweet rice and sprinkled with sugar. Like many Chinese dishes, this sounds repugnant by itself. But a bite of Tian Shao Bai is a perfect moment, almost an antidote when the mouth is aflame from a bite of a ma la dish. This idea of using sweet as a countermeasure to salty or spicy used to be common in the West. Apicius prescribed adding honey to a dish that is too salty. Pliny phrased it in reverse. Salt corrects our aversion when we find something oversweet. In medieval Catalonia, salt cod was served with honey. Platina prescribed sweetness as a counterbalance to la. Sugar softens and tempers all dishes of hot and aromatic spices. This is the reason the people of Goyur make their spicy, sweet Banyuls wine to accompany their salty anchovies. But in the 18th century, dessert, a word from the French verb meaning to clear the plates, became such an elaborate showpiece in Europe that sweet was gradually eliminated from the rest of the meal. When the dessert idea was first taking hold, a dessert was sometimes served at the end of each course, and a course was often a combination of dishes. In China, a course is still an assortment of foods in the middle of the table, often on a large rotating disc, a lazy Susan, which makes all the platters easily accessible. People sit around the table with only a small plate or bowl, and with chopsticks take a bite of one, then another dish, mixing the combinations, a bite or two of hot, then a taste of sweet. In all of the courses, vegetables play a significant role. In Sichuan, wild mountain vegetables such as mushrooms are a specialty, as are numerous varieties of bamboo shoots eaten raw, cooked, or preserved in salt. The first course is usually an assortment of foods that are cold in temperature, the second an assortment of heated ones. The last course, especially in Sichuan, where by this point the palate has been through a great deal, is bland, usually a very bland soup. Sometimes a course of white rice is served before the soup with very salty baokai. Rice is usually not served with the other courses. Except among the very poor, many meals do not include rice at all. Historians debate exactly why food in China is seasoned with products fermented or pickled in salt, and not with grains of salt added directly to food. The idea of producing saltiness without the direct use of salt is Asian, though it is not that different from the Roman use of garum. The following recipe for the Sichuan classic Hui Guo Rou is an example of cooking with salted condiments, in this case, three, but without using salt directly. The recipe is by Huang Wengen, a cooking instructor at the only accredited school of cooking in China, which is in Chengdu, the capital of Sichuan. For authentic Hui Guo Rou, you must have these ingredients. Pork thigh, garlic greens, douban, douxi, soy sauce, sugar, and MSG. Boil the ham until it is nearly cooked. Cool it. Cut thin slices perpendicular to the bone. Chop garlic greens. In a wok with mixed vegetable oil, stir-fry meat until the slices begin to curl a little. Add douban and douxi. When the sauce turns reddish, add soy sauce and a pinch of sugar with a pinch of MSG. Use small amounts of all these ingredients. Finish with the chopped garlic greens. Like so many Chinese dishes, this one uses pork. The 18th century French naturalist Georges-Louis Leclerc du Buffon speculated that the reason Islamic proselytizing was not very successful in China was the Islamic rejection of pork. The Chinese not only cook fresh pork, but also have a long tradition of salt curing pork into bacons, hams, and sausages. In 1985, the pig population of China was estimated to be 331 million, which is far greater than that of any other country in the world. According to a survey of rural China conducted from 1929 to 1933, pork and pig lard accounted for 70% of animal calories consumed. The cooking oil, usually a blend of sesame, peanut, and other vegetable oils, that is used in so much Chinese cooking, is often a modern, healthier substitute for pork fat. According to Huang Wengen, you cannot cook Sichuan food without douban. We went to France and I brought douban because the douban in France is no good. It was a 6-week cultural exchange program of cooking teachers, a school near Lille by the narrowest part of the channel, Le Touquet. But it was impossible to teach Sichuan without the products. Hua Jiao, for example. We brought what we needed that was practical to carry. Hua Jiao, douban, douxi, shakai. All of these irreplaceable ingredients except Hua Jiao are salt products. Shakai is vegetables in salt. Douban is a bean paste from a big, flat, green soybean that is dried until it turns hard and yellow and is then fermented with salt and hot pepper. Douxi is a black paste made from fermented yellow beans, very salted, but without chili. Another ingredient seen by the Chinese as a salt alternative is MSG, or monosodium glutamate. While it has no flavor of its own, for reasons that are not completely understood, MSG brings out flavors that exist in foods, especially the flavor of salt. Yu Jiamin at Beijing's Sichuan restaurant said, MSG is a different flavor than salt, but also brings out flavor the way salt does. As more Westerners visit their country, many Chinese cooks are growing frustrated by what they see as a Western prejudice against MSG. Liu Tong, a cooking instructor of the Sichuan cooking school in Chengdu, said, "It is not a chemical. It is made from fermentation of cereal. We have always used it in Chinese food." Actually, the Chinese have not always used it, but the Japanese have. In food history, MSG swam upstream, from Japan to China, instead of the reverse direction of most Asian food. Traditionally, the Japanese got it naturally from a seaweed known in Japanese as kombu, and in the West as laminaria. MSG was first isolated as a substance, a sodium salt of glutamic acid, in a Japanese laboratory in 1908. Since the 1950s, it has been made by fermenting wheat gluten. Liu Tong said that MSG was needed because Chinese food does not directly use salt. There are numerous Chinese salt and bean condiments, such as Daoban and Daoxi, and the Japanese have their own assortment. But the most important is the ancient soy sauce. In China, school children learn a jingle from the Middle Ages with the seven necessities needed every day. Firewood, rice, oil, salt, soy sauce, vinegar, and tea. In China, there is an ancient tradition of soy sauce made by peasants, but such sauce is becoming a rarity. Today, in both China and Japan, soy sauce is made in factories. Most Chinese say that it is a complicated process, and the factories do it as well as the peasants ever did. Anyone who has tasted the thick peasant product might dispute this. Huang Wengen, for one, said the old farm product was incomparably better. The farmers in Dayan said they stopped making soy sauce in the early 1990s, even when they were still pumping brine with foot pedals. They said it was too much work, and that factories sell it so cheaply, they could not compete. But by a strange twist of economics, an artisanal soy sauce is still made in the Sichuan town of Leishi. Leishi is a provincial town whose main street has almost no traffic other than busy little three-wheeled bicycle rickshaws. And yet, most of the old buildings have been torn down and replaced with what is becoming China's ubiquitous white tile architecture. At night, it looks as if a tricycle gang has taken over the deserted streets of an abandoned housing project. The Leishi Fermented Product Corporation was a private factory that was nationalized after the 1949 communist takeover, known here as the Liberation. The state factory made an industrial soy sauce. But in 1999, in a fit of privatization, the state announced that it was no longer going to produce soy sauce in Leishi. Since no one was interested in buying the company, its 100 workers were given severance pay and left jobless. 10 of them used their settlement money to buy the company. In order to get operating capital, they sold the large downtown plant and moved up a 3-flight outdoor mud and stone stairway to a storage area on a hilltop at the edge of town. They no longer had the equipment or the capital to be an industry. So they decided they would have to make their soy sauce the way peasants used to make it. Xu Shidi, the general manager, said, "We had to start all over. This is the old way to do it." Factories use the crushed refuse from soy oil production for making soy sauce. But the new Leishi company uses fresh whole beans that are steamed until soft. The beans are then placed in a storage room on flat, round straw trays that are about 4 feet in diameter. Yeast is then added. The trays are left on bamboo racks in the concrete storage room for 3 days until mold forms on top. At this point, factories speed up the fermentation process by delaying the addition of salt and keeping the beans in heated bins. But in Leishi, the moldy beans are mixed with water and salt and stored in big, 3-foot-deep crocks. The pots are left outdoors to ferment for 6 months to a year or longer, depending on weather conditions. When it rains, they are covered with cone-shaped lids made of sewn palm fronds. Eventually, the paste looks like mud. Water is added, and the mush is slowly filtered through piping. Then, it is sterilized by steaming. Some sauces are darker, some lighter, some thicker, some thinner. The best Leishi sauce is not quite as thick as its number two product, but it is black, caramelly, and complex. Differences in sauces are determined by the length of fermentation and the amount of water added at the end. In Leiji, soy sauce is still sold the old-fashioned way. Customers bring their own bottles, and the sauce is ladled out of crocks. But it is also marketed under the label Wobo, which is the name of a local bridge. A room in the dank little factory has a shiny new machine, the only shiny new thing in the plant. The handful of people that is the company, some in suit and tie, others in workers' clothes, all entrepreneurs of the new China, look on with excitement as this machine seals soy sauce into plastic bags to be sold out of town. China is changing quickly. The gray and red courtyard buildings of Beijing, some 500 years old, are being torn down at a pitiless rate. In the glare of neon lights that now explode in the sky every night on top of the capital's new high-rise buildings, are Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's advertisements. Fried chicken has been easier to sell than hamburgers, because the Chinese have been eating fried chicken for centuries. Guo Shenshong, a 63-year-old professor who lives in a small apartment stacked floor to ceiling with books in a 10-year-old apartment block that already looks 80 years old, does not fit perfectly into this new China. He dresses simply, studies his books, takes great pleasure in traveling to international academic conferences, and appears not to have heard the news that China has switched to a market economy. He cares little for the new consumerist China with its Western labels, both real and fraudulent. Like most Chinese, he still eats the old foods. He once went to a McDonald's. What did he think of it? He shook his head disapprovingly and said, "No vegetables." Chapter 25. More Salt Than Fish. The idea that salt enhances the taste of sugar has not entirely vanished from the West. It is a guiding concept of the snack food industry. A clear example of this is honey-roasted peanuts. But in fact, salt and sugar are ingredients in most industrial snack food. Before refrigeration, when butter was preserved with considerable quantities of salt, sugar was thought to counteract and even mask the saltiness. Since tasting is all that is needed to detect oversalting, some merchants try to mask this taste by adding a little sugar. So in tasting salted butter, if you detect a sweet or sugary taste, don't buy it. Francis Mar. Défendez votre estomac contre les fraudes alimentaires. Protect your stomach against food fraud. Paris, 1911. Curiously, the concept of sugar counteracting salt still flourishes in Sweden, a country which imports both its salt and its sugar, and perhaps for that reason gives them equal regard. The first record of sugar in Sweden is from 1324, when, for a funeral of the wealthiest man in the country, 1.5 kilo sugar, 1.5 kilo pepper, 0.5 kilo saffron, all exotic luxuries, were imported. According to Carl Jan Granqvist, a well-known Swedish restaurateur and food commentator, sugar brings out the saltiness of salt. Cakes are made with salt. Breads are made with sugar. In September, when crayfish are in season in Sweden, they are served with salt, sugar, and dill. Sugar and salt is a leitmotif of Swedish cooking. There is even a Swedish word for it, sockersaltad, sugar salting, which is also the first ingredient listed on many labels. For newcomers to Scandinavia, one of the more infamous uses of sockersaltad is salt lakritz, salted licorice candy, which sometimes comes in the shape of herring, sometimes in laces, or in a gumdrop shape called a salt bomber, with salt sprinkled on top. A salt lakritz-coated vanilla ice cream sold on a stick is a lakritz puck, though the manufacturer, G.B. Glasse, said it was made with ammonium chloride, not sodium chloride, which does not seem at all reassuring. Swedes often mention salt lakritz as the one thing they miss when they go abroad. Other Scandinavians and the Dutch are afflicted with the same craving. Also high on the list of foods missed by Swedes abroad is caviar, a name which purists would see as a travesty, since it contains no sturgeon eggs. Caviar is salted cod roe, mashed with potatoes and sold in a squeezable metal tube. The first ingredient listed on the tube is sakkarsaltad. The leading use of sakkarsaltad, and probably the one that has kept the taste in the northern palate, is for curing fish. On the west coast of Sweden, herring is ground with onions and made into fritters, which are served with a sweet currant sauce. One of the most celebrated expressions of this Swedish taste is gravlax, literally buried salmon. Originally, gravlax was salmon that was cured by being buried in the ground for days or months, an old Scandinavian technique used for preserving herring as well. The longer it is buried, the longer it will keep. But, paradoxically, the longer it has been buried, the more it resembles in smell and texture something rotten. Older Icelanders still horrify youth with smelly little chunks of hákarl, buried Greenland shark. Burying produces a very smelly fish rejected by most of the public. The Swedes have maintained the popularity of gravlax by replacing it with salmon cured with salt and sugar. Herring still comes and goes in the Baltic and the North Sea in ways no one can predict. The sea between Norway, Denmark, and Sweden is called the Skagerrak. Kladdesholmen, a flat, rocky island only yards off the Swedish coastline in the Skagerrak, has had only 6 good herring runs recorded in all of history. The first was in the 16th century. Then the herring went away and did not return until 1780. From 1780 to 1808, Kladdesholmen was awash with herring. The villagers boiled herring in water, and the oil that rose to the surface lit the street lamps of Paris and London. In those years, while herring seemed to be vanishing from the Norwegian coastline, the large population on the tiny island of Kladdesholmen were fishing and processing herring, as well as cod and ling. The 2 boiling plants, owned by wealthy Göteborg and Stockholm merchants, made oil 24 hours a day. Then in the early 19th century, fewer herring showed up each September. Some blamed this on the foul smell of the island, with its herring oil plants dumping stinking waste back into the sea. Kladdesholmen smelled so bad, it was said, that even the herring couldn't stand it. There was not another good run until 1880 to 1900, and there were none in the 20th century. More than 1,000 people lived on the island in the 18th century. By the 21st century, the island had only 470 inhabitants. In the early 20th century, hundreds of women had been employed cutting up herring for canning, wearing aprons made from Cuban sugar sacks, waterproofed with linseed oil. Men mixed salt for the herring with Cuban sugar, then added sandalwood, ginger, cloves, mace, coriander, cinnamon, allspice, oregano, dill, and bay leaf. In the 1980s, there were 200 herring workers. Today, more herring is produced with fewer than 100 people working for 8 herring canneries, all of them family-owned businesses. For the small companies on Kladdesholmen, it is more economic to buy barrels of fish from one of 2 companies that now process herring for all of Sweden. They buy herring and cure it in a brine in which, for every 13 kilos of salt, 9 kilos of sugar are added. At the big herring plants, decisions about these formulas are still made by the brine mixer, who, like the master salters on the old-time cod vessels, has the highest salary. But life has changed in all of Sweden. Until a lumber boom in the mid-19th century, it was one of Europe's poorest countries. Before the 1960s and 1970s, the only refrigeration in a Swedish kitchen was cabinets with holes to the outdoors in the wall. Historically, salted provisions got Sweden through its long winters, and traditional Scandinavian food is very salty. A Swedish sausage is coated in a white layer of salt. In Sweden, Apfelflask used to be made in the fall when the apples came in. They were sliced and sautéed in salt pork and sugar syrup. But today, everywhere in Scandinavia, as in much of the rest of Northern Europe and North America, people are eating less salt and less salted foods. Few eat Apfelflask anymore. Some of the disappearing uses of salt seem so strange it is difficult to understand why they were ever popular. Snus is tobacco and salt. It was molded into a wad with the fingers, jammed up between the cheek and gum, and sucked on for an entire day. Fresheners were added every hour or so. Some even put it in before going to bed and woke up at night for a fresh wad. And even the Swedes wonder at the habit of the Laplander in the far north, drinking salted coffee. Salt consumption is declining in most of the world. The average 20th century European consumed half as much salt as the average 19th century European. But there is still a love of salt cod, herring, hams, sausages, olives, pickles, duck, and goose preserved in salt. Foods that are no longer necessary. Salt cod is sometimes sold only slightly salted so that it requires less soaking, though this convenience is at the expense of quality. Some salt cod is so lightly salted that it is kept frozen, which makes little sense economically or gastronomically. Bacon and salted beef remain popular, but because they are now refrigerated, are no longer so salted that they need to be soaked before using. Since salt curing has lost its function as a way to preserve meat, the paradoxical notion of fresh ham has appeared. By Swedish law, a ham that is salted in September cannot be called a fresh Christmas ham. But a ham that is frozen in September and thawed and salted on December 17th is a fresh Christmas ham. In North America, the Jewish delicatessen is a citadel of salt-preserved foods. Foods that could just as easily be purchased fresh, including pickled cucumbers and tomatoes, salted and smoked salmon, carp, whitefish, and sable, and cured meats such as tongue, pastrami, and corned beef. Pastrami, of Romanian origin, is dried, spiced, and salted beef, smoked over hardwood sawdust and then steamed. The name may come from pastra, the Romanian verb to preserve. It is available in every delicatessen, but most famously as the specialty of Schwartz's in Montreal. Schwartz's and its pastrami is such an institution in Montreal that after the controversial 1977 Bill 101 required store names to be in French, a language that does not use apostrophes, Schwartz's was one of the few allowed to keep its apostrophe. But it had to change from being a Hebrew delicatessen to a charcuterie hébraïque. While the Jews and the delicatessens are concentrated in eastern North America, much of their fish is taken from the Pacific. Great Lakes carp is becoming rarer, and an inexpensive substitute was salted and smoked sable or sable fish, a huge deep-water Pacific fish. In the Pacific Northwest, it is known as black cod, though it is nothing like a cod and belongs to a uniquely northern Pacific family. Now that it has become fashionable in the United States and Japan to eat black cod, it is becoming rarer, too, and cured sable is no longer inexpensive. Though curing salmon is an ancient tradition everywhere that the fish is found, Jews who learned of it in Germany and Central Europe, where it had long been a popular food, did much to popularize it in the world. It was through the Jewish immigration neighborhoods of Paris after World War II that cured salmon became a staple item of Paris charcuteries. In New York also, it was the early 20th century Central European Jews of Manhattan's crowded Lower East Side who first established cured salmon as a New York food and then as an American food. The popular Jewish cured salmon was called lox, Yiddish for salmon, from the German lax. Lox is salt-cured salmon, usually Pacific salmon. In the 19th century, the Pacific Northwest became a leading center for cured salmon for both the East and West. The booming fur trade of the region bought large quantities of salt. The merchants in the Northwest found that salted salmon sold well in the world and that the ships bringing in salt could buy salted salmon for their return cargo. Hawaii was a salt supplier for the Northwest. Like many Pacific islands in the 18th and 19th centuries, Hawaii had an important trade provisioning whalers and other ships with salt and salted meats. Hawaii produced sea salt in inland lakes, the most famous of which was a volcanic crater rumored to be bottomless. Evidently not true, since the drained salt lake is now in Honolulu, filled with high-rise buildings. Hawaiians traded salt in the Northwest and in turn bought salted salmon, a hard product that required soaking like salt cod. Hawaiians still mix soaked salt salmon with tomatoes, a dish they call lomi lomi. The word means massage and refers to the process of flaking the salt fish. Salt-cured lox, once the leading cured salmon, has in recent years been almost completely abandoned for the less salty nova, a lighter cure, soaked in brine and then smoked. In recent decades, there has been a mantra among Jewish shoppers, get the nova, the lox is too salty. The name comes from Nova Scotia, though most nova originally came from the nearby Gaspé Peninsula of Quebec. Now there is Western Nova, made from Pacific salmon, because Atlantic salmon has all but disappeared, except for farmed varieties. Mo Greengrass, owner of a popular Jewish smoked fish store on Manhattan's Upper West Side, started by his father in 1929, said, "Nobody buys lox anymore. We sell 100 pounds of Nova and 5 pounds of lox per week." Mo's father, Barney, who had worked in fish stores on the Lower East Side before opening his West Side store, was one of those who had made lox a New York food back when New Yorkers liked their fish salty. Anchovy is a fish that has remained more popular salted than fresh. But because salting is no longer a necessity, it has become considerably less salty. J.B. Raboul, the 19th century Provençal chef, is credited as one of the first to use anchovies creatively, inventing anchovy pâtés and several pastries with anchovy fillings. He also wrote one of the great recipes of a Provençal classic, anchoide. After having washed 7 or 8 anchovies, let them soak several minutes in water to desalinate. Having separated the fillets from their bones, place them in a dish with several spoonfuls of olive oil, a pinch of pepper, 2 or 3 garlic cloves chopped fine. You could also add a splash of vinegar. Cut a slice about 1 inch off the top of a pain de ménage, or pain ordinaire, a long, round, typical French bread. This is the best choice of bread because it does not easily crumble. Divide this long slice of bread into 2 or 3 pieces. They should be the same. Make 1 for each guest. Place some anchovy fillets on each piece and arrange the pieces in a dish. Cut the remaining bread into small squares. Everybody dips the squares in the prepared oil and then uses the square to crush the fillets on the bread. When it is all crushed together, anchovy and sauce, you eat the squares of bread that were used for crushing while toasting the slices with crushed anchovy on top. It releases typical flavor that fills with joy all lovers of Provençal cooking and gives pleasure to many a gourmet. J.B. Raboul, La Cuisinière Provençale, 1910. Another celebrated 19th century Provençal chef, Monsieur Morard, wrote, "The laziest of stomachs and the sleepiest of appetites are obviously forced to awaken at the first mouthful of this stimulating slice of bread, made golden with olive oil, awaiting crushed anchovy fillets and chopped garlic, that the culinary mosaic maker has so perfectly placed on top." In 1905, Henri Matisse and André Derain went to Collioure, the little pink and yellow village by the sea, still famous for its anchovies. In one of the most fruitful summers in the history of art, they produced paintings of furious colors. Derain painted a village of pure primary color, and Matisse a village of vibrant opposites, turquoise and orange, magenta and gold. They took their paintings to Paris's Salon d'Automne that year and created a sensation, a movement in the art world known as Fauvism. Visit the little port of Collioure today, a few miles up the Catalan coast from the Spanish border, and these works of Matisse and Derain will seem purely imaginary. Collioure is no longer a world of brilliant colors, but subtle pastel walls, where wisteria blooms pale purple and magnolia pink. What is missing are the fishing boats. Derain painted them red and yellow, their bright red masts poking out of the harbor like an autumn grove. Matisse depicted them in a red bunch seen from his turquoise window. They were exaggerating the colors, but the fishing boats, called Catalans, truly were painted in blazing primary colors. These were the boats of anchovy fishermen. In 1770, Collioure had 800 fishermen working on 140 Catalans. In 1888, the number of boats had declined by 10. The fishermen observed that anchovies will rise near the surface on a night with a full moon. Reasoning that the fish were attracted by the moon, they started making their own moons once they had electricity, and they called them lamparos. A lamparo was a huge light on a buoy that was some 5 feet high, carried out to sea, hanging from a hook mounted at the bow of the boat. On a calm, moonless night, the fishermen would set their nets around the buoys and then turn on a lamparo and wait for the anchovies to gather under it. Then they would haul up a full net. The Catalans would go out every night and bring the catch in every morning for salting. The catches were good, but the more they caught, the farther out to sea fishermen had to go to find anchovies. Fishermen started using big, steel-hulled ships for the longer voyage, but such vessels could not dock in Collioure because the harbor was not deep enough. By 1945, there were only 26 working Catalans left in Collioure. Today only one Catalan sits in Collioure harbor by the medieval walls. It is an unused souvenir of the village's anchovy industry. Art lovers, wanting to see the town Matisse and Derain painted, flock to Collioure for the tourism season, which, like the old anchovy season, is May to September. But the colors, the fishing boats, are not there. The locals still make bagnoles from their vineyards in the winter, and in the summer, instead of fishing, there is the tourism. Two families still salt anchovies in Collioure, using salt from Aigues-Mortes. The anchovies are caught in Port Vendre, a contemporary hillside monument to industrial efficiency. It has a fleet of vessels that find the schools with sonar, and an afternoon fish market that auctions the catch. But Matisse would not have painted it. A number of 17th and 18th century writers insist that the heir to garum is not anchovy sauces that later became ketchup, but salted fish eggs, caviar. Guido Panzeroli, who wrote a 1715 book titled History of Many Memorable Things Lost, believed other types of garum called botarga and caviar now take their place. The word caviar is of Turkish derivation and refers to the eggs of the sturgeon, a prehistoric animal that has not evolved in 180 million years. It is a huge migratory fish that, like the salmon, is anadromous. That is, it lives in salt water, but swims upstream to spawn in the freshwater place of its birth. The eating of its eggs may well be as old as or even older than the eating of garum. Originally, the eggs were food for fishermen, cheap food because they were not saleable, whereas the fish itself brought high prices. But gradually, the eggs gained appreciation. In 1549, their preparation was described by Cristoforo de Mezzisbugo, a Renaissance food writer from Ferrara. caviar to eat fresh and to conserve. Take sturgeon eggs, the best of which are black. Spread them out on a table using the blade of a knife. Take out the ones that are filmy, weigh the remaining ones, and for every 25 pounds of eggs, add 12 1/2 ounces of salt, or 1/2 ounce per pound. The medieval rivers of Europe were full of egg-bearing sturgeon. They were common in the Seine, the Gironde, the Thames, the Po, the Danube, the Ebro in northern Spain, and the Guadalquivir in southern Spain. The fish were often a subject of royal privileges. The British monarch, starting with Edward II in the 13th century, claims the right to the first sturgeon caught in British waters every year. France produced caviar since at least the time of Louis XIV, largely from the sturgeon catch on the Gironde River. But sturgeon caught on the Seine, even in Paris, was a rare enough event for the fish to be presented to kings. Colbert regulated the fishery to preserve the fish, and these laws are still in force. But the fish are gone. Louis XV got a Paris sturgeon in 1758, and Louis XVI got one in 1782. Antonin Carême, the famous early 19th century French cook, insisted he saw a 220-pound sturgeon, almost 3 yards long, by the Pont de Neuilly on the western edge of Paris. That was one of the last sturgeon sightings in Paris. Sturgeons, which can weigh up to 2 tons, have little resistance to industrial pollution. Even the Gironde, the last holdout of French sturgeon, became too polluted, as did the Hudson and other great sturgeon rivers of North America. When Europeans settled in North America, they recorded seeing Native Americans catching huge sturgeon. Even in the 19th century, American rivers had sturgeon. Caviar was served as a free bar snack in the hope that, as with peanuts, the saltiness would encourage drinking. During World War I, British soldiers were fed cans of pressed caviar, which they called fish jam, and mostly loathed. A soldier would pay for cans of sardines rather than eat the free fish jam that was issued. For caviar to have been considered the heir to garum, it had to have been used as a seasoning rather than being eaten by itself. Until the 20th century, that seems to have been the case. In 19th century Russia, sauerkraut was valued more than caviar, and in this recipe, the caviar is simply a pleasant salted flavoring for the cabbage. Sauerkraut with caviar. Boil 3 pounds shredded sauerkraut, adding only enough water to prevent it from burning. When it is cooked, drain in a coarse sieve. Melt 1/2 pound finished butter in a skillet, stir in the sauerkraut, and fry both together. Pour salted water over caviar that has just been removed from a fresh fish, mash it fine, mix with the sauerkraut, and let it boil thoroughly over the fire. The caviar will impart a fine flavor to the sauerkraut. This dish may be served with patties, small sausages, or fried fish. On fast days, substitute olive oil for the finished butter. Add enough caviar so that the sauerkraut appears as if it were strewn with poppy seeds. Elena Molokovitz, A Gift to Young Housewives, 1897. Apparently, by the early 20th century, Americans valued Russian caviar from the Caspian Sea. In 1905, Russia was in open revolt against the Tsar, and in April 1906, an American publication, Wide World Magazine, warned, "The unrest in Russia, it is feared, will greatly affect the caviar industry." The writer was concerned that the Cossacks would get involved in the political unrest and abandon fishing sturgeon. But the magazine did see reasons for revolt. It reported that the Tsar forced the Cossacks to give him a yearly tribute of 11 tons of their best caviar, and reported that this tribute alone required the killing of 5,000 sturgeon at the start of each season. The article described the Cossacks in the Russian winter, standing on the ice and fishing through holes. It reported that the eggs were mixed with the finest salt at a ratio of 4 to 5% salt. The Caspian, fed by the Ural and Volga rivers, is the world's largest saltwater lake. Not only does it have sturgeons, it has sea salt, where brackish water evaporates at the mouths and estuaries of the numerous rivers that empty into it. Before the 1917 revolution, the Cossacks were the dominant caviar producers of the Caspian. They fished sturgeon only twice a year, for 2 weeks each time, and the sturgeon seemed inexhaustible. The entire Cossack population participated in these two brief fishing seasons. First, in the autumn, whole extended families pulled nets down the Volga River. The second, 2 week season was in the middle of winter, and this fishery also was on the river. Armed with harpoons, hundreds of Cossacks would stand on the ice of the frozen river awaiting a cannon blast that was their signal to pierce the ice and attempt to spear a sturgeon. The noise would drive the terrified fish downstream, and the Cossacks would follow with their harpoons and cannons while merchants from Moscow, Leningrad, even Paris and other European capitals waited for the giant fish to be cut open while still alive. The price has been leaping upward since the beginning of the 20th century. From 1900 to 1915, the price of caviar doubled. Merchants began importing Russian caviar, not to mention French caviar with Russian labels, to exclusive establishments in Western Europe. This was how the Petroshin family, today one of the leading caviar distributors, got started. Born on the Iranian side of the Caspian, they grew up on the Russian side, immigrated to Paris, and discovered that Russian things were in vogue with the rich. During the 20th century, as industrial pollution and oil spills killed off sturgeon around the world, commercial caviar fishing was largely reduced to the Caspian Sea. Historically, the Caspian has always been controlled by Russia from the northern shore and Iran from the southern shore, giving these two nations a virtual monopoly on caviar. But the Caspian and the Russian rivers that feed it have also been besieged by pollution. Chemicals and fishermen have killed so many sturgeon that by the early 1970s, even the Russians were suffering a shortage of caviar. In that decade, increased industrialization in Iran started threatening the Iranian fisheries on the southern side of the lake. At this point, the price of caviar became prohibitive to most people. Sturgeon is still fished in the Caspian only twice a year, with a larger catch in the spring and a smaller catch in the fall, hauled by net from its habitat in the deepest pockets of the Caspian floor. Once landed on a factory ship, the sturgeon receives, as do many fish caught by man, a clunk on the head. The blow knocks the fish unconscious and permits the fisherman to open it live and remove the roe. The eggs must be passed through a wide screen to separate them from other fibrous matter, and then they must be delicately mixed with salt, both to preserve the eggs and to bring out the taste. As is often the case when preparing food, there is a delicate trade-off. The more salt, the better preserved, but the less salt, the finer the taste. Preparing the caviar takes careful labor, which also increases the cost. In general, Iranians salt their caviar less than Russians, although each fishery is slightly different, and in fact, each fish is different, which is why the eggs in any sized can of caviar are all from the same fish. Of the 24 known varieties of sturgeon, 3 are still fished for caviar in the Caspian. The prices of the caviar from the 3 varieties, beluga, ofsetra, and sevruga, are not a reflection of quality, but rather of the rarity of the fish. The giant beluga are hardest to find, and therefore their caviar is the most expensive. It takes 20 years for a female beluga to mature, and at that point she can weigh as much as 1,800 pounds and be up to 26 feet in length. Such a fish could yield 20 pounds of eggs. Beluga have the largest eggs, and these smoky gray bubbles are also the most delicate eggs, which is another reason they are the most expensive. More beluga eggs are broken and lost in processing than any other kind of caviar. The dominance of Caspian caviar has been declining, and it now represents only about 3/4 of the world supply. With Caspian caviar growing scarcer and more expensive every year, there have been attempts to bring back European and American caviar, partly through farmed sturgeon, yielding such scrupulously labeled products as the American paddlefish caviar. Boutargue. Take the eggs from a fresh mullet, best when in season, and take care not to break the delicate skin surrounding each egg, and add a discreet amount of salt to the eggs, neither too much nor too little, and leave this way for a day and a night. Then place it in smoke far enough from a flame so that it does not feel the heat. When it is dried, then place it in a wooden box or barrel surrounded in wheat bran. This botarga is typically eaten uncooked, but those who want it cooked can heat it under ashes or in a clean, warm oven, turning it, but just until it is hot. Martino, Libro de Arte Cocinaria, Book of the Art of Cooking, 1450. Little is known of Martino, including his full name. He was born in Como, worked for aristocrats, and was one of the most respected and influential Italian cooks of his day. His botarga recipe calls for mullet eggs and is smoked rather than pressed. Botarga, which the 18th century Panzerolle had listed with caviar as a possible descendant of garum, varies with the fishery. Native Americans used to make it by pressing and drying sturgeon eggs. Today it is usually salted, pressed, and dried fish eggs. In Tunisia, botarga is made from mullet eggs and is a product associated with the Jews of Tunis, the same way smoked salmon and pastrami are associated with Jews in North American cities. But the name is thought to come from the Arab bitarik, and it was also made in ancient Egypt, probably also from mullet. Today in Italy, botarga has come to be thought of as a Sicilian food, specifically from western Sicily, and that means tuna, not mullet eggs. The tuna trade on the west coast of Sicily combines one of the oldest salt works in Europe and one of the oldest tuna fisheries. Between the two, the port city of Trapani juts out on the triangular tip of a narrow peninsula. Typical of Sicilian towns, Trapani has a Phoenician, Roman, Norman, Arab, Crusader history. These elements are reflected in the architecture, the language, the food, and the customs. Everything in Sicily is built on layer after layer of history. All the people who came, conquered, built, were defeated, and left. The Castiglione Tuna Company, just north of Trapani, makes more than 2,000 pounds of botarga every year, which Sicilians grate over spaghetti with olive oil, garlic, and chopped parsley. The eggs come from the bluefin tuna that enter the Strait of Gibraltar once a year and swim past western Sicily to their Mediterranean spawning grounds. Each female has 2 huge rows weighing between 6 and 7 pounds each. Workers prepare a brine from the local sea salt and wash the rows in it, and then cover them in the coarse grain salt that is a regional specialty. They then place a 30-kilogram, 66-pound weight on the salted rows. More weight is added every week until, by the end of the month, 60 to 70 kilos, the weight of a middle-sized man, are pressing on the salted rows. After pressing, the rows are dried in the sun for a week. Like the sturgeon fishermen of old, the Sicilians sell off the fish and eat the eggs. But they also sell the botarga all over Sicily. They sell the tuna hearts as far away as Palermo, the Sicilian capital. Latume, the delicate-tasting salted male reproductive gland, is for locals in the Trapani region, as are tuna intestines, stomach, and esophagus. For centuries, this coast was famous for its salted tuna as well. But these days, Sicilians don't eat their bluefin tuna in any form. They sell it fresh for dazzlingly high prices. 90% of the local catch is landed 1 hour after being killed and instantly sold and flown to Japan. The passage of the bluefin off the Mediterranean coast at spawning time was first observed by the Phoenicians, who set up what is called in Sicilian Donaris. As various cultures became dominant in this passage between Sicily and Tunisia, the tonara became layered in ritual. Today it only continues in two places in Sicily, the little waterfront town of Banagia, just north of Trapani, and the small nearby island of Favignana. The tonara in Banagia is owned by the Castiglione Company, which usually, despite the high prices from Japan, loses money on it. The bulk of its profit comes from yellowfin tuna caught elsewhere and bought and packaged by the company. The bluefin is vanishing not because of the tonara, but due to far more efficient fisheries in the Atlantic. Eugenio Giocamazzi, the Castiglione production manager, said that 1,000 pounds of bluefin is now considered a good catch. That used to be three or four fish. One fish, according to ancient accounts, but today it is a net full, because fish species, as they become scarce, mature younger and become smaller animals. Castiglione has 150 employees, but every March another 120 are hired to work the tonara. The leader is known by the Arab word reis, and the fishermen sing an Arab song, Chalamet, to invoke the gods for the hunt. But the final kill goes by the Spanish word matanza, which appropriately means slaughter. The tuna hunt begins in March with men on the narrow waterfront of Banagia repairing and arranging nets as they sing traditional songs, part in Sicilian and part in Arab. Instead of exhausting the fish on the end of a line in the Sicilian tonara, the bluefin is worn out by being led through a series of nets over a number of days. A net wall 150 feet high, 4.5 miles long, is anchored to the ocean floor running east to west. In May and June, the tuna enter the Mediterranean. Approaching the coast of Sicily, they turn south to pass through the straits between Sicily and Tunisia, but instead hit the net wall and run along it into what is called the island, which is a series of net rooms. In ancient times, the large fish were guided through the rooms by men with long sticks. Today, this is done by a scuba diver known as the Big Bastard. The bastard of Banagia, Maurizio Giuseppe, said that as he swims with the ill-fated fish, he passes amphora and other ancient artifacts of shipwrecks from the Phoenicians, the Greeks, and the Romans. The Big Bastard's job is to coax the tuna from one room to another. Each of the rooms has a name, until after about 2 weeks the fish are exhausted, awaiting their fate in the Camera di Matanza, the slaughter room. The net is hauled up, and 55 fishermen in a long boat spear and gaff fish. It is an ancient way of fishing tuna. 2,500 years ago, in The Persians, Aeschylus, describing the Greek destruction of the Persian navy, said it was like slaughtering tuna. The large bluefin, even though tired out from the weeks of manipulation, thrash and struggle. The Mediterranean turns black with their blood, and the foam of the water turns scarlet as they are stabbed, gaffed, landed, and shipped to Japan. The tonara fishermen spend March repairing the nets, April setting them up on the ocean floor, May or June fishing, then taking the nets back up. Then it is July, time to work the salt harvest. South of Trapani, along the coast, earthen dikes begin to appear and a few stone windmills. The dikes mark off ponds, some of which hold turquoise water, some pink. The stone towers of windmills stick out from these orderly